Wouldn't you love to get paid for doing what you love to do? If you're ready to move on to what's next, join us for Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. Our uplifting live talk show on Saturday mornings from 10 to noon will have you circling back, not running in circles, to pull your experience forward in new ways. Advance your career, plus help others with theirs. Join us Saturdays, 10 to noon, right here on 104.1 The Truth, for pragmatic advice and unconventional wisdom. Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, where your path is created by walking on it. Well, welcome back to Circles of Change in our final segment today. It's a real pleasure. You know, folks, quite often we focus on personal career change and organizational change, but today my guests and I are going to challenge you to take it up a few notches, because we want to now talk about real societal change, and particularly in the context of the United States. So with great pleasure, I'd like to welcome Jeffrey Sachs to the show. How are you today, Dr. Sachs?
I'm delighted to be with you. Thank you so much.
Good. What a pleasure. And our listeners will understand as we get through this that Dr. Jeffrey Sachs is currently director of the Earth Institute and professor of health policy and management at Columbia University. A native of Detroit, he spent over 20 years at Harvard University studying economics from bachelor through his doctoral research, then joining the faculty and leading the International Institute for Development. Widely considered to be the leading international economic advisor of his generation, Dr. Sachs continues in the forefront of the challenges of economic development, poverty alleviation, and enlightened globalization, promoting policies to help all parts of the world to benefit from expanding economic opportunities and well-being. In 2004 and 2005, Time magazine named Dr. Sachs among the 100 most influential leaders in the world. He's been advisor to two United Nations Secretary Generals and is president and co-founder of Millennium Promise Alliance, a nonprofit organization aimed at ending extreme global poverty. He's also one of the leading voices of combining economic development with environmental sustainability, and as director of the Earth Institute, today leads large-scale efforts to promote the mitigation of human-induced climate change. He's author of hundreds of scholarly articles and many books, including the New York Times bestsellers Commonwealth, Economics for a Crowded Planet, and The End of Poverty. And the book today we're going to talk about is The Price of Civilization, Reawakening American Virtue and Prosperity, which was just released in October. So congratulations. Is this going to be up to bat three times with another bestseller?
Well, it has made it onto the bestsellers list, so I'm delighted and thrilled about that. I think people are finding it interesting. And for me, it is a kind of trilogy. Mm-hmm. I wrote The End of Poverty about the crisis of the poorest countries in the world, and that was in 2005. Then I wrote Commonwealth about the global environmental challenges, and because one of the greatest complexities of our age is that even when we have the economy growing, we have to do it in a way that isn't going to destroy the environment, given how crowded the planet has become. We've just welcomed the 7 billionth human being.
Right.
On Halloween Day this year. So with 7 billion people crowded onto the planet, we have to pay attention to the environment. This book, The Price of Civilization, is the third of this series. And in a way, it's a book that I didn't expect to write and actually, of course, didn't want to write, because it's a book about American society not functioning properly.
That's right. And in fact, now you said it was a trilogy, but I gather, though, from what you just said and also the wonderful way you launch your book, is that, as you said, you weren't expecting to write this book, but it's such a compelling topic that it's kind of welling out of you, right?
Well, I just felt that having spent so much of my time in more than 100 countries around the world looking at problems of other countries and expecting, to be quite frank, that I'd never really have to do that about the United States, because I always felt we have a great country and our problems pale in insignificance,
right,
sometimes compared to what other parts of the world are facing. I did really come to feel that I had to do this for myself and for whatever I could add to the American dialogue and deliberation right now, because we're in a mess, and it's a pretty serious mess. And for people that are not at the top of the wealth and the income distribution in America, people are hurting right now. And, of course, everybody knows members of their family or their friends or their neighbors or their communities, their cities, that never bounced back from the big financial crisis of 2008, have lost a lot of confidence about what's happening in our country, feel very estranged from politics because politics seems like a game of the powerful that isn't doing much to help the average American. And I felt that I needed to understand this better myself and try to use the tools that I've developed in more than 25 years of facing economic crises and trying to address them in other places to look at the situation in the United States and see what I might be helpful in indicating.
And indeed, the name of the book, again, is The Price of Civilization, Reawakening American Virtue and Prosperity. And for those who aren't familiar with Dr. Sacks, you'll understand when you pick up the book with all the credentials and wonderful recognition that indeed he is a macroeconomicist. And, you know, in the economic world that you carry a lot of tentacles and influence. But the delightful part about this book, I might add, is it's absolutely readable to us common man that may not be as versed in those tools that you talk about. I've got it up in front of me, of course. Part one is The Great Crash, where he does a wonderful job of taking us on that historical road trip, I'll say. And the second part is The Path to Prosperity. Share with us, thus, you're going back and revisiting perhaps some of that data that you were already conversant in, given that you've been in the field so long, but also what were some of the ahas and how did they pop your way to help frame up the real challenge you wanted to share in this book?
As I wrote this book, it really was like peeling the proverbial onion. I take off one layer, what happened in 2008, what happened with the Lehman crash, how did we get there, only to reach the next layer. Why was it politically that the financial markets were deregulated in such a dangerous way in the 1990s? Then another layer, because that really took us back to the first wave of deregulation of the financial markets in the 1980s. That took me to another layer. Why was it that when Reagan became president in January 1981, he made a fateful statement, a famous statement of that era? He said that government is not the solution to our problems. Government is the problem. And the book, in a way, is really an analysis of that statement. And I have to say, as I thought about it, and it was a kind of aha for me, how did we come to a situation where the President of the United States really took as a core position that government was not an instrument of problem solving? Now,
which is particularly frightening, of course, because he's the steward of that great machine, purportedly.
Well, that's the conclusion that I'm going to have to say it pretty bluntly, that if somebody says government's not the way to solve our problems, probably it's best for them not to become president, because we need presidents who believe that the instruments of the Constitution and federal power can be used for problem solving. Reagan took us in a different direction. He took us in the direction of tax cuts, especially for the rich, of deregulation, of a kind of mythology, I'm sad to say, of that the markets would do it all. And this is what I trace when I finally get down to it in the first half of the book. I say essentially the following. In the 1970s already, the U.S., which was the dominant world leader, was starting to face a new kind of world economy.
You bet.
One where we had competition from abroad. We weren't used to that because after World War II, we were the world economy. We were rebuilding Europe. We were rebuilding Japan. But by the 1970s, we had the OPEC oil exporting countries. We had Japan really competing effectively with us in electronics and in the automotive sector. We didn't even realize at the time that in 1978, one of history's most important changes took place. Mao Zedong had died and Deng Xiaoping had become leader of China. And China would become, over the next 30 years, the second largest economy in the world and really America's toughest competitor. Now, in 1979, we reached the peak of our manufacturing employment. Another thing we didn't realize that was happening, we reached a peak of 19 million jobs in manufacturing. We're at about 10 to 11 million jobs today. A lot of those jobs have gone overseas. A lot of those jobs are now done sometimes by automation and computers, but a lot by workers abroad in the so-called emerging economies.
And Dr. Sachs, wouldn't you also say that during this period of the 30 to 40 years, that term globalization has taken on such a deeper, richer meaning because it's not just about movement of jobs or export imports. It's about this dynamic interconnectedness that touches every single system, right?
And these days, of course, when Steve Jobs died, and with all of the unbelievable things that that Apple and he brought to the world, we're thinking a lot about our iPads and our MacBooks and iPhones and so on. And it's amazing, great innovations, but employing some tens of thousands of people in the United States, but hundreds of thousands of people in China. That's where the products are being produced, selling products all over the world, an integrated production system, a global marketplace, an ability of corporations to hide their international profits in tax havens like Bermuda or the Cayman Islands. Everything has changed with globalization except for one huge problem, and that is that President Reagan and the presidents that followed did not want to ask the hard but most important question: what should the government be doing to help the economy and to help society to adjust to these massive changes? We needed to up our game in competitiveness, in energy systems, in infrastructure, in skills, in education levels.
Right.
The proportions of children completing high school, of course, but also of our kids that are able to get their way through a bachelor's degree, of certificate programs, technical skills, expert craftsmen in the new economy. We just went a different way, and it's been for 30 years, cut taxes for the rich, deregulate, let Wall Street have its way with us, live through one financial bubble after another, but not, sad to say, take seriously our future.
Well, I think there's another piece of your book, though, that really the path to prosperity, which, of course, is the second part of the book, that I at least feel that you're sending these messages to all of us that we as citizens hold equal accountability in many regards because we've allowed, as you coined the phrase, a distracted society to come about. And, as much as you might say those politicians in government are doing X, Y, Z or not doing it, but let's step back and be mindful of, well, who put them there to start with?
Well, so this is really an important question for each of us. I point out we have these new challenges. Our government did not take them on. Instead, the government became beholden to powerful lobbies, Wall Street, big oil, the private health insurance industry, and so forth. This really led our government astray. We haven't done the hard work we need to do. But I end the first part of the book with asking, so where are we? Yes, this is a democracy. We are the citizens. We vote. But not only is our political system really in the hands of big money and glitzy round-the-year media campaigning and really propagandizing, I would say, but unfortunately, Americans are stuck in front of the tube. We're watching more television, imbibing more advertisements, living that hyper-commercialism that is American society these days. And I think it has also played a role in deranging our politics because we have to ask the question, okay, Reagan got off track. Okay, he missed the big point. But why has it continued till now?
Continued
you could say, okay,
yeah.
Well, yes, of course, the lobbies, they're important. The money in politics is corrupting. But why do we as citizens let it continue to happen? Why do we get fooled so easily? Why are we Why are we voting for candidates that just continue the same process? And there I do think our distractedness, our time in front of the tube, our kind of mass consumer society to the exclusion of civic activity, I think has played a role. And that's what brings me to the second part of the book, What Are the Solutions?
Well, in fact, you'd also say, you mentioned earlier, iPads, cell phones, et cetera. This isn't just about the two. This is about anything that has a screen on it, right?
It is up to 8 or 9 hours a day in front of a screen these days for most of us. It's amazing.
What is very nice, then, about this transition in the middle of your book, then, to part two, is that you start out with words, the mindful society. And this touches in so nicely with your other work around the globe, Dr. Sacks, around really the elimination of poverty, dealing with the really tough human issues that are out there, that many of which are not touched within our country to nearly to the extent. But this mindfulness about, and you even said, it's not so much that productivity is the issue, but it's the way in which we're living with that new productivity.
We have everything, you know. We have the ability to solve our energy problems. We have the technologies to address our health needs. We certainly have the resources to ensure that our children, even those in poor households, are going to get a good education. We're just not doing it. We're not making that extra effort. We've also been fed a kind of diet of greed. We've been told to be selfish in various messaging. Why should we care for others? Oh, the poor, they're lazy. The unemployed, they just don't want to work hard. We hear a lot of this, actually a shocking amount of it, in a society in which people are really hurting right now, really hurting. We have a lot of disdain that we're hearing from some of our candidates and some of our elites and people who are out of touch. They have enough money. They're just not really experiencing the reality that many Americans are living through right now. And we used to be a lot more sensitive and, I would say, compassionate to all of this. Now, one of the remarkable truths of all of the great philosophers, I talk about Buddha and I talk about Aristotle, and one could talk about the teachings in the gospel, and so many of our other basic ways of knowledge and teachings in the ages, is a point that compassion is not a luxury for us as human beings also, but it's actually the way to our own satisfaction.
Right.
There is so much hard psychological data right now that the people who have put money as everything in front of them end up the least happy.
Well, in fact, you can go to any bookstore and notice how the sections on self-help and things about the happiness factor are you know, quadrupled in size on the bookshelves, or the Kindle scroll button, whatever you want to call it. And you're saying, now, what is with that? And I think some of it goes back to your even comment of the need to return to civic responsibility.
Let's get a grip. You know, first, I do think we ought to turn off the tube much more, and go out and get some fresh air, and actually, you know, participate in our community in a variety of ways, and as better citizens. But it's also the case that one of the great traditions of America was the sense that participating as a citizen was an act of high honor and high responsibility.
Yeah.
We had a president who said, of course, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. It's a sentiment that stirred Americans for generations, but where do we hear it right now? We ask, what can our country do for us in tax cuts? This seems to be the whole discussion that we hear in these debates right now for the presidential candidates. And enough of this, because the title of the book, The Price of Civilization, is making a point. It's paraphrasing the great Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., who said that taxes are what we pay for civilization. He actually said, I like to pay taxes. That way I pay for civilization.
That's right. And he's got the ownership.
This basic point.
And well, so you know, I think for particularly for you, since you have this vantage point of having spent 20 some odd plus years out helping other cultures, other societies, countries dig through the issues that they have, and that then the perspective to look back on your own country and realize that these fundamental underpinnings that make us so proud to be Americans, and nowhere in your book, by the way, are you really bashing that Americans aren't good people or don't believe that we do well, but it's how more can we turn that so it becomes the pervasive approach to doing things, not as divisive as it seems to have become here.
That's exactly right. And I would also say that this book, for me, was kind of a relief as well.
Yeah.
Because I was worried, what's happened to American values? What's happened to compassion? And the biggest problem we have, we are distracted, but the biggest problem is not our values. The biggest problem is a breakdown from our values to what's coming out of Washington. And that's where we need to reconnect. Because the American people show when they're asked, when they're given the chance to express their views, they show a continuing compassion. They want a decent society. They're not out to bust the unions, to hurt the poor, to break government. There is a minority that is doing that. They're often very rich. They're often very self-serving. They may be corporate lobbies. They may be gaming the system. But the majority of Americans are decent and moderate. They're not ideological. They want what's going to work well for themselves and for their children. And they are ready to contribute. But Washington broke down because of the lobbies, and we haven't held our politics accountable because we haven't really been participating decently as citizens ourselves. So it leads me to two points in the end. One is, what should we do? And I'm suggesting that, first of all, the very wealthy who have done spectacularly well in the last 30 years, while the rest of America has been in stagnation or even falling into poverty, the rich have just had a boom, a bonanza beyond imagining of the rest of society. And they absolutely have to be called on it to step forward, pay their taxes, stop with the loopholes, stop with the tax havens, stop with the lobbying, stop with the special pleading, and they have to pay more. And they've just had a free ride up until now, and boy, some of them are putting in huge resources, David Koch and Rupert Murdoch and others, to try to keep getting more. But it's greed that is out of control, actually. And
then on the flip side, of course, we have some, though, that have chosen to be much more philanthropically oriented. And really quick, your second point, then?
And the second point is that we need an awakening of our politics again.
You bet.
It's not true that you just have to sell yourself to the lobbies to get elected. And I think that this Occupy Wall Street movement, it's our kids opening the eyes of the country that we can do better. And I think it's the start of something new. The last chapter of my book is actually about the millennial generation, about the young people 15 to 30 in the country. I wrote it before the Occupy movement started. I felt, because I see it in my classes, that they're ready to take on a more idealistic and a more inspired, but also practical and hard-headed way out of our mess. And so I'm delighted personally that they're stepping up and saying, we are the 99%. We want a country and a democracy that works for everybody. We don't want the impunity at the top. We want a country in which there's general responsibility. And I think that that's what this movement is about.
Absolutely. Well, Jeffrey Sachs from Columbia University, the book is The Price of Civilization, Reawakening American Virtue and Prosperity. Thanks so much for joining us today here on Circles of Change with great
Absolutely
gratitude.
Absolutely delighted. Thank you so much.
You bet. Change is chaotic, that is, unless you embrace it, going places you hadn't dreamed were possible. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, is a leadership consulting, executive coaching, and career transition firm. We help individuals make the most of their current employment situation or to step forward confidently into a career transition. Contact us at thelarsongroup.com or toll free 1-877-544-2580. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, helping others unleash potential through transformational change. 1-877-544-2580.